It is Monday, May the 28th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, has North Korea met its match in President Trump?
The North Koreans are used to Americans giving in to a certain extent and not really putting up anything in the way of response to the North Korean misbehavior.
Islamic State might be down, but not out in Syria.
They still have capability. They're transforming into more of an insurgency, guerrilla-type operation, and so I think this is the type of thing we're going to be seeing more and more.
Also ahead, a new documentary about an American war hero and senator now struggling with brain cancer. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. and North Korean officials met in the demilitarized zone to talk about a possible summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Mr. Trump had pulled out of that summit last week before reconsidering. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked RAND Corporation senior defense analyst Bruce Bennett for his read on the on-again, off-again summit.
Well, I think the expectation of the U.S. government was that it would all be ups, that Kim Jong-un had decided to take denuclearization seriously, and it was all going to proceed forward. But the history of working with North Korea is that they always like to get the last little ounce they can. They are serious about trying to get the details on their favor. And it's also not clear whether we've got some degree of misbehavior by North Koreans or what. I mean, they failed to show up for a meeting 2 weeks ago in Singapore with the American advance team. Hard to tell what was going on. Was this something Kim Jong-un was trying to marginally get some advantage out of? Or was this a case of people just not doing what he was telling them to? It's hard to tell.
Well, it is hard to tell, which of course must lead to speculation, which we don't always like to do, but sometimes we have to do it. And now the speculation is not only on what's happening in the White House as far as divisions within the White House are concerned, but also what do you have to say about the possibility of divisions in Panmunjom?
Well, I think certainly the potential for divisions within the North Korean government. I mean, Kim Jong-un has established control of the country based upon an extremely ruthless approach of killing a whole lot of people. There have to be a lot of his elites who really don't like him, and in particular don't like the idea of offering up their nuclear weapons as something that they're prepared to give up to get better treatment economically. So there could be some pushback, or this could be a strategy to move ahead. This could also be his charm offensive to try to take control of South Korea. Because he said his New Year's Day address, which is the State of the Union address for North Korea, he talked about unification a dozen times in that address, and he didn't mean a South Korean-led unification. He meant unification under his control. So is he working towards that as well? We just don't know.
How do we know that that's what he was talking about?
Oh, because the text of his message was published, and his family for decades has talked about unification. But when they have, it has always been the same message of this being unification under North Korean control.
Now, what about denuclearization? A lot is being made about the definition of denuclearization in the Korean Peninsula. What does that mean, do you think, to either of the leaders?
Well, first of all, Kim Jong-un has been anxious for a long time, and his father before him, to meet with the U.S. president and develop the appearance for internal political purposes that he's a peer of the American president. The nuclear weapons give him the feeling that he should be able to do that now, that he's got nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles that could potentially deliver them. And so a part of what he's anxious to do is to cement his internal control in North Korea. He wants to appear to be very powerful. In order to do that, denuclearization can't be a one-sided event. It can't be from his perspective that he's giving stuff up and not getting some comparable U.S. action. So he may well be trying to work to a position of saying, look, United States, you need to denuclearize too. That's only fair. And I'm your peer, President Trump, so talk with me about what nuclear weapons you're giving up.
Do you think that Donald Trump has met his match as far as a deal maker with Kim Jong-un?
Oh, I think quite the opposite, actually. I think Kim Jong-un has finally met his match. The North Koreans are used to Americans giving in to a certain extent and not really putting up anything in the way of response to the North Korean misbehavior. That's not what's happened with President Trump. Back when President Trump did his UN address where he talked about Rocket Man, Kim Jong-un wrote a personal response 2 days later. And he said two amazing things. Number one, he said, I didn't anticipate President Trump was going to say this. Well, wait a minute. In North Korea, Kim Jong-un is supposed to be the god. How is it that he can be a god and be fallible, that he didn't understand it? And the second thing he said was, it's a North Korean statement, a frightened dog barks louder. But the whole rest of his area of his statement is showing that he's barking louder, calling names and making threats. For once, Kim Jong-un is frightened by President Trump. I don't think he's been frightened, or his father before him, by previous American presidents.
Bruce Bennett is a senior defense analyst at the RAND Corporation, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. Russian Defense Ministry says four of its military personnel were killed in fighting in eastern Syria. Meantime, Washington has cautioned Syrian President Bashar al-Assad against broadening the conflict there. Syrian government forces, fresh from their victory against an Islamic State pocket in South Damascus, are moving into southern regions. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Trinity University scholar David Lesh what he makes of all of this, especially the Islamic State remaining active in Syria.
The epitaph of the Islamic State in Syria has been written too soon. Certainly, their hold on territory has pretty much vanished, except for a few pockets along the Syrian-Iraqi border. But they still have capability. They're transforming into more of an insurgency, guerrilla-type operation. And so I think this is the type of thing we're going to be seeing more and more from various jihadist groups, including the remnants of the Islamic State.
Is Deir ez-Zor the next line of action, if you will, in Syria?
Well, there are several where the government could go. They want to retake some territory in the south along the Jordanian border. Of course, there's Idlib, where most of the anti-government opposition still reside, and where many of those that have entered into reconciliation agreements with the government, they've been bussed out to Idlib. So that's the one remaining large pocket of anti-government opposition. But they, there are also al-Qaeda elements there, but not the Islamic State. Deir ez-Zor is a very volatile area for different reasons, in the sense that you have U.S. and U.S.-supported forces there that last February had engaged in an intense firefight with Syrian pro-government Syrian elements as well as Russian elements, and as many as 200-300 Russian contract soldiers were allegedly killed in that firefight. And, that is where they are faced off against one another. I mean, I think that's the tripwire for something very dangerous happening along the Russian-U.S. divide in Syria. That's the tripwire right there. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. There are still jihadist elements in that area as well, closer, more east to the east of Deir ez-Zor. But right now in Deir ez-Zor and around Deir ez-Zor, it's a dangerous situation where there are Russian-supported elements facing off against U.S.-supported elements that have already come into conflict with one another in the past. And so despite the deconfliction lines that exist between Russian and U.S. Military personnel, it's still quite volatile.
These are more than just government troops from Russia, but reports suggest some of them may be private Russian mercenaries.
Yes, and it seems that that gives the Russian government plausible deniability in terms of not being behind or ordering the movements of these particular troops. And these are the ones that were behind that were involved in that firefight against U.S.-supported troops and against U.S. troops themselves back in February. So, this is not unusual. We've known that Russian contract troops, mercenaries, have been involved in Syria since the beginning. And it allows the Russian government a little bit more flexibility to involve themselves on the ground with Syrian government and other pro-Syrian government troops without having to tell their public or even report the deaths accurately of those contract troops.
One government official tally of Russians killed is 92 in Syria, although unofficial estimates apparently are even higher than that. Russia's paying an increasing price for its presence.
And that's why I think Russian President Vladimir Putin wants to engineer a political settlement as soon as possible in Syria and is putting tremendous pressure on Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who recently visited with Putin in Sochi a couple of weeks ago, to try to compel him to make the necessary concessions for a political settlement. It seems that Bashar al-Assad has moved the needle a little bit in that regard in agreeing to a constitutional committee and so forth. We'll see, if the words actually lead to deeds in that regard, which it hasn't happened in the past. But some sort of political settlement that would allow the Russians to fully withdraw, to withdraw much of their troops from Syria so these types of things don't happen again, because they're starting to mount. They're harder to hide and to keep quiet back in Russia itself. And they've pretty much attained their objectives. They've kept Bashar al-Assad in power, kept their naval base along the Mediterranean coast in Tartus, and expanded it. And they've built a new air base up in the north outside of Latakia. So they've solidified their position in a key area of the Middle East. They just don't want it to become a quagmire a la Afghanistan.
David Lesh, a distinguished professor of Middle East history at Trinity University, speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. On this Memorial Day here in the United States, when the nation remembers those men and women who have made the ultimate sacrifice of their lives in military service, HBO premieres a documentary about the life of Senator John McCain. It is an illuminating, exclusive profile of one of the most influential forces in modern American politics. John McCain, For Whom the Bell Tolls, also features interviews with family, friends, colleagues, and leading political figures. VOA's Lori London talks about the film with 6-time Emmy winner, producer-director Peter Kunhardt, and asked him about whether Senator McCain's diagnosed brain cancer prompted the film.
Yes, there was. The diagnosis triggered the film. When we heard that Senator McCain had been diagnosed with brain cancer, our minds shot back to when Teddy Kennedy got the same diagnosis, and we moved into high gear and produced a film for HBO about Teddy Kennedy's life under kind of tight time constraints. So we proposed to HBO that we do a similar thing with Senator McCain, the other lion of the Senate, and we did feel like we wanted to get it out and finished while Senator McCain was alive. It's interesting you raised the issue of kind of an obituary. Our thought was we very much wanted to capture the true John McCain while he was alive and talk to the people who knew him best while he was alive in the present tense, not in the past tense. And the rationale for that was that I think when someone dies, people tend to kind of get their own little narrative together that sums him up and puts him in the past tense. And we didn't want that. We wanted to talk to people who knew him or were close to him in the present tense and without knowing what the future held, except that he was in bad physical shape. We perceived it as a way to get the most real, honest, true, and emotional reactions from the people who knew him and from the senator himself.
I don't think a living eulogy is necessarily a negative thing either, though. I mean, I think a lot of people would like to hear what people say about them and to sort of look over their life, look back on their life, remember things, talk about it, especially someone who's had so much in his lifetime and has done so much for the country as well. Did you have a goal in mind in making the film, as far as besides getting the information out there? Was there a message or something you wanted people to take away from it?
Pretty soon after we had begun, we realized that the message of the film, in addition to trying to color in John McCain's life, was that he does have a message. And the message is, I think this country's system of government is broken. I think it's time that we get together. I think his call for bipartisanship is something that's sorely missing today. And he felt that he had the background and the track record to remind senators that this was something that we needed to get back to. What we found very interesting is the consistency of this message. I mean, it resonates today in this kind of messy, crazy political world we're in. But he was saying the same thing 10 years ago and 10 years before that and 10 years before that. He's been very consistent in the process, due process in legislation and working across the aisle. For a maverick and kind of a feisty, temperamental guy, he's very consistent with how he sees government working, and he thinks it's not working now.
And the film really does a great job of combining his own voice. I think it's fascinating to have unseen home movies and photographs and archived TV footage. And of course, all of the interviews of all of these very famous, well-known people that know him.
Well, we reached out to all the people who kind of populated, or many of the people who populated his stories. Many of them were his political opponents in various races, and many of them were Democrats as opposed to his fellow Republicans. It was the first film we've worked on where everyone across the board said yes, they wanted to be part of it, and opened up their calendars and got us right in there to talk about it. They all have a soft spot for John, even his most bitter political opponents. Hmm. He ran for president against George Bush, and he ran against Barack Obama. Both of them adore him and wanted to say that and wanted to talk about him and remember him.
What do you think it is about him that endears him to even people who are his staunch opponents?
That's the key question, and I think it's a very simple answer. He's a really decent human being. We had never met him before, our production team, and we went out to Sedona, Arizona, spent a few days with him, and he has no pretense. He has no veneer. He is what he is. He's a very engaging, fun, straight-shooting, normal kind of guy. He was very generous with his time, and we came away just liking him. And I have a feeling, on some level, that's what his political opponents and fellow senators feel, too. He's the kind of guy you like spending time with.
Obviously, I'm sure he's seen the film now, all put together.
Yes, that is true. My son, Teddy, one of the producer-directors, went to Arizona 2.5 weeks ago, right after he was still in the hospital having had intestinal surgery, and he screened it for him, and McCain watched very quietly, and at the end, he put his hand on Teddy's hand, kind of patted his hand, and said, thank you, you nailed it, and he really appreciated it. But he's a man of few words, but he was clearly touched by it and thought we captured the essence of his story.
Does he talk about how he wants to be remembered, or how he stays positive despite all these immense obstacles, and this one, obviously, the fight of his life?
To me, the most interesting thing that he wants people to remember about him are his mistakes in judgment. He holds himself to a high bar, and it's both his family's personal values, the military values that were instilled in him, his own political values that he carried forth. But every time he makes a mistake and doesn't follow his values and something backfires, he wants to remind you that he did that and that he then tried to fess up to his mistakes and do better next time. So he spent a great deal of time being very hard on himself, trying to convey to people that we all make mistakes, follow your inner compass, your moral compass. You won't go wrong, but if you begin ignoring that, you will make mistakes. I found that refreshing.
Peter Cunhardt is the producer-director of the new HBO documentary about the life of U.S. Senator John McCain. He was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. For Muslims, the month of Ramadan, which is going on right now from May 15th to June 15th, is a time of reaching out to people who are less fortunate. Islamic Relief USA is providing thousands of special Ramadan food packages to people in need in several cities in the United States. The nonprofit in Alexandria, Virginia, also contributing humanitarian aid to more than 40 countries around the world. VOA's Deborah Block takes us to where the food packages are making the lives of some local families a little easier.
Here at the Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center in Falls Church, Virginia, Maliku Abu Merak from Morocco says the food the mosque is handing out from Islamic Relief USA will make a great deal of difference to the five people in her family.
I am happy to see the basics we cook with, like rice, sugar, and oil. The food is also helping my friends who live nearby who need help.
A number of people who are taking home the food are from Latin America or refugees from Iraq and Syria, says the Islamic Center's social services director.
The top numbers are coming from Syria, and it's really sad to see a family. The head of the household is looking for a job, and of course, as we all know, even those with master's degree would barely find a job that can bring food.
Before Ramadan, volunteers for Islamic Relief USA packed the supplies in boxes at this warehouse in Virginia. The 1,000 boxes are also being distributed during the holy month to non-Muslim social service groups in the Washington area.
We don't really distinguish based on religion, color, creed. You know, it's part of our mission. So the boxes that they'll be assembling today, although distributed for Ramadan, are to all families in need of all different faiths.
Some people came to volunteer with family or friends.
I like the feeling of helping people, especially when in this month, because it's Ramadan and we're supposed to be like the best people we could be.
One of the pillars of Islam is charity, so we're just trying to fulfill that here.
Hannah Ben Sadek made the long drive from Southern Virginia to help out.
Me and my family decided we would just take the 5-hour drive just to come up here so that we can participate in something, because we just want something that I know like makes a difference and makes an impact on the day-to-day lives of people.
Back at the Islamic Center, Teresa Dick is grateful for the help.
I thank Islamic Relief for this food, which helps me and my family a lot, especially during the month of Ramadan.
After sunset, when Muslims end their daily Ramadan fast, Sadiq says the food is a welcome addition to her family's evening meal. Deborah Block, VOA News, Falls Church, Virginia.
Still ahead on International Edition, everything you wanted to know about Rolling Thunder. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study published in the journal Cell Metabolism suggests cutting back on calories in the daily diet may not only benefit the obese, but also those who aren't looking to lose weight. Analyzing data from the calorie or comprehensive assessment of the long-term effects of reducing intake of energy trial, the study authors found that aging and metabolism slowed in those who decreased their daily caloric intake by 15% over a 2-year period. They discovered that restrictions in calorie consumption also provided some protection against neurological conditions considered to be age-related, such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases, as well as others like cancer and diabetes. Past research indicates a slower metabolism can be beneficial for healthy aging and perhaps a longer life. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. And as I mentioned earlier, it is Memorial Day here in the United States, which for many people, it's the beginning of the summer season. But on this day, every year, Americans remember the U.S. war dead. For more than 3 decades now, on the Sunday preceding Memorial Day, tens of thousands of motorcyclists have rumbled through the streets of downtown Washington, all a part of what's known as Rolling Thunder. VOA's Jim Stevenson has our story.
The Vietnam War in the late 1960s and early 1970s was difficult for U.S. servicemen during and after the conflict. It was an unpopular war in the United States, and many questions have lingered about servicemen who were unaccounted and did not return home. The idea of a protest to address the issue was born in 1987 by Marine Corps Corporal Ray Manzo. In gathering support for his idea, he met Army Sergeant Artie Muller.
The more we investigated, the more we found out we just wanted to do something. We decided to do a demonstration down here. In the first 3 years, we did a march and a run. And then after that, we decided we're just going to do the run. And it went from 21 to 2,500 motorcycles the first year. two. Last year, they said we had over 500,000 motorcycles and some 900,000 plus people.
Estimates of Vietnam POWs and MIAs have varied. Personal issues forced Ray Manzo to drop out of Rolling Thunder's annual planning. But with later wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Mueller has kept the demonstration going.
We're here to demand the government do something about the lives they left behind. We're also here to support our troops that are serving now, to tell our government, if you want to direct our military and tie their hands, then they better put a uniform on themselves and tie their own hands and let somebody shoot at them. Don't put our military in harm's way and make them tie their hands.
Sergeant Mueller's wife, Elaine, is also heavily involved in Rolling Thunder.
It was going to be a march and a few motorcycles. And this went on for about 2 or 3 years, and it seemed like the marchers decreased and the motorcycles increased. And since it was named after a bombing mission in Vietnam, it seemed really appropriate. It's not that we're a motorcycle club, but many clubs do support us. It just escalated.
And she says the Rolling Thunder demonstration is not just about Vietnam-era soldiers.
We're supportive of our all veterans, and we're very supportive of our military. So that's why we continue our mission. It's the POW issue, but also we do a lot in VA hospitals. And through Rolling Thunder Charities, we're now helping needy military families and veterans who need help.
The throngs of motorcycle riders come from all across the United States each May. Michael Edwards is the president of a Rolling Thunder chapter in Wisconsin.
It's about a 15-hour ride, 16-hour ride. They leave Green Bay, Milwaukee, Chicago, go to Buckeye Lake, Ohio, stay overnight. And then they arrive on Friday afternoon about 1 or 2 o'clock here in Washington, D.C. But the total group, plus Rolling Thunder members, is probably 120, 130 bikes from Milwaukee.
And as a veteran, he says the issues pressed by Rolling Thunder remain very serious.
We took the same oath of office as these legislators did, and the same oath of office that the president took, to defend the Constitution of the United States. And we take it seriously. Even though some of us have been out of service for 40 years, we're still veterans.
Virtually every military veteran among the sea of motorcycles staged in the Pentagon parking lot in Virginia echoed the same sentiment about their ride into the nation's capital just across the Potomac River.
This is a First Amendment right. It's the freedom of speech, and we're not going to be silenced.
The Mullers say applications for permits to hold Rolling Thunder next year will be submitted on Tuesday, the day following Memorial Day. In Washington, Jim Stevenson, VOA News.
And many thanks to you, Jim, and everyone else who contributed to the program. And thank you for listening here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Up next, the latest world news, so we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the last Monday in May, Americans honor those who have fallen in defense of the country and of its ideals. It is a solemn day, this observance, on which we gather to remember those who have made the ultimate sacrifice for us and to pay them homage. The occasion, originally called Decoration Day, began in Illinois in May 1868, when General John A. Logan of the Grand Army of the Republic, a local organization of Civil War veterans, proclaimed the day as a time for the nation to decorate the graves of the Union war dead with flowers. The purpose of the remembrance, he said, was to cherish tenderly the memory of our heroic dead, who made their breasts a barricade between our country and its foes. The practice spread throughout the country, and in 1966 the name was changed to Memorial Day, and at the same time it became a federal holiday. And so on every Memorial Day, small flags and bouquets of colorful flowers spring up on headstones and memorial plaques in cemeteries all over the country, decorating the graves of military heroes. Every one of these decorations represents a member of the military who died protecting his or her country and what it stands for. They died defending a way of life and values they believed in, and the honor they earned by their sacrifice abides with them forever. It is often said that as long as we are remembered, we remain alive. Thus, on Memorial Day, we recognize the valiant efforts of the hundreds of thousands of men and women who put the country and what it stands for before themselves. They remain with us in spirit, and every Memorial Day, we honor and dignify their offering. On every Memorial Day, a grateful nation remembers its heroes and recognizes that lives and blood lost in defense of its freedoms are never given in vain.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.